Imagine you're handed this leadership manifesto for a major historical institution.
Right.
You are probably bracing yourself for the usual corporate jargon, right? I mean,
Yep.
synergy, optimizing bandwidth,
The
deliverables.
standard strategy deck we've all sat through a million times.
Exactly. But what if you open it up and find something that reads more like a profound philosophical treatise on human well-being?
That would be a surprise.
Yeah, a document arguing that the secret to elite world-class output isn't grinding your workforce down to the bone, but rather actively protecting their vulnerability.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we are immersing ourselves in a document that attempts to do exactly that.
It really is it's a fascinating piece of organizational literature. We're looking at the 2026 to 2030 Dean Election Program. And this was written by Benedict Lemelein for the Faculty of Theology and Religious Studies at KU Leuven in Belgium.
And just to give some crucial context here for you listening, this isn't some scrappy tech startup trying to, hack its company culture with ping pong tables.
Definitely not.
KU Leuven is an academic titan. It is approaching its 600th anniversary in 2032. So we are talking about 6 centuries of institutional baggage.
Baggage, tradition, prestige, all of it.
Right. This document is essentially a blueprint for leading a deeply historical academic faculty through a modern, rapidly secularizing, and highly disruptive world.
And that historical weight is exactly what makes the proposed management style so unusual. Our mission for this deep dive is to extract the core principles from this academic text and translate them.
Because they apply to you.
Exactly. Because whether you are navigating the corporate tech sector, managing a hospital ward, or leading a team anywhere in between, the insights here about leadership, building trust, and structural empathy are incredibly relevant.
Yeah, totally.
But we should establish right away that this isn't just a collection of utopian ideals. It is heavily grounded in an external audit, specifically the IDE-RESIS analysis.
Okay, let's unpack this because those acronyms can sound like absolute alphabet soup. For anyone outside of Belgium, what exactly is an IDB-RASIS audit?
It's an important detail. So IDBE is an external, independent Belgian organization focused on occupational health and safety.
Okay.
And a RASIS analysis specifically evaluates psychosocial well-being in the workplace. It measures things like stress, burnout risk,
Toxic power dynamics.
toxic power dynamics, and overall psychological safety. So when this manifesto proposes new leadership strategies, it is doing so as a direct, data-informed response to an objective evaluation of the faculty's real vulnerabilities.
It's not just guessing what the problems are.
Exactly. It has the receipts.
Okay, because one of the most striking arguments early in this text is its absolute rejection of chronic pressure.
Yeah, it tackles that head-on.
The author points out this deeply ingrained, really stubborn misconception in our modern working culture, this idea that excellence and well-being are essentially at odds with one another.
There is this pervasive myth that if you want a team to be truly excellent, you have to sacrifice their balance.
Sacrifice their health and their peace of mind, exactly.
And we see that trade-off normalized everywhere, from Wall Street to Silicon Valley to high-level academia. The assumption is that diamonds are only made under pressure.
Right.
But this manifesto explicitly tears that idea down. It argues that creative thinking, the kind of serendipity required for genuine scientific breakthroughs, it simply does not happen when people are operating in a state of chronic fear or exhaustion.
They flourish when they feel existentially safe.
Existentially safe, yes.
The text makes this argument that excellence and well-being are actually two sides of the same coin. And she draws on some very old historical frameworks to illustrate how this is supposed to work in practice.
She does. She leans into the rich monastic and biblical tradition, which obviously makes sense for a theology faculty. She specifically references the Benedictine rule of ora et labora,
which translates to pray and work.
pray and work, exactly. Now, stripping away the strictly religious context, the core operational idea there is existential balance. It is the recognition that drive, ambition, and passion for your research are vital.
But they shouldn't consume you.
They should never be allowed to morph into a form of slavery. Work is meant to be a component of a well-lived life, not the entirety of it. You should become more human through your work, not less.
So think about your own workplace for a second. Have you ever felt the need to invent a little white lie?
Oh, we've all been there.
Right? Or maybe a convenient excuse just to leave a Tuesday afternoon meeting early so you could pick up your kids from school, or take an elderly parent to a doctor's appointment. The manifesto argues that the need to hide your life outside of work should be completely dismantled.
It shouldn't require an excuse or a feeling of guilt.
And this is where the document moves from philosophy to actual policy, which I love. It treats the right to disconnect.
Meaning actually shutting down your email and digital presence on evenings and weekends.
Yes, shutting it all down. It treats that not as a special favor granted by a benevolent boss, but as a fundamental structural right.
It is framed as a necessary boundary to protect a person's inner freedom.
Right. The logic is that an employee who is allowed to fully disconnect will return to their work with the kind of mental clarity that actually produces elite academic output.
Now that sounds wonderful in theory, but as we mentioned earlier, they had that ID Wiebe Rossis audit.
Oh, right, the reality check.
What's fascinating here is that the audit provided a harsh reality check, because over the previous 4 years, the faculty had genuinely tried to improve.
They hadn't just been ignoring it.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
They introduced formal disconnection policies, they appointed a faculty pastor for psychological support, and they created these things called THEO teams.
And for context, THEO teams were essentially localized collaboration pods. They were designed to break down the notorious silos in academia, encouraging different departments to actually talk to each other and support one another.
Right. So they put all these well-meaning initiatives in place. But the audit came back and revealed an uncomfortable truth. Despite the new policies, trust is still not felt equally across all levels of the institution.
Which is a classic organizational trap, isn't it? You can implement all the wellness initiatives you want, but if the underlying power structure remains rigid, people still won't feel safe.
Exactly. And to address this, the document pivots to a model of servant leadership.
Servant leadership.
The author makes a very tangible, almost risky promise for an incoming dean. The first step of her mandate will not be to dictate new rules or immediately appoint her preferred leadership team.
Which is what everyone usually does.
Right. The very first step is an uncompromising commitment to just listen.
And not just passive listening. The text emphasizes deep, uncomfortable listening.
Uncomfortable is the key word there.
Right. Listening to all the different, sometimes conflicting voices in the faculty before a single decision is made.
Receptive observation. It requires setting aside your own ego and agenda to truly understand the friction points. And to grasp why that listening tour is so critical, you have to understand the rigid hierarchy of a European academic institution.
Yeah, let's break that down for the listener.
The text segments the faculty into three distinct groups. First, you have the ATP, which is the administrative and technical staff.
The people who run the IT systems, manage the admissions, and keep the literal and metaphorical lights on.
Exactly. Then you have the ZAP, which are the tenured professors and senior academic staff who carry massive research, teaching, and administrative loads.
Okay, ATP and ZAP.
Yes. And finally, you have the ABAP. These are the young researchers, the teaching assistants, and the PhD students. They are the engine of the faculty's future output.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the document provides a razor-sharp analysis of that specific group, the ABAP.
It really does.
It openly calls out the inherent power dynamics between a young PhD student and their promoter, meaning the senior professor guiding their research.
Right. Because in this system, your promoter essentially holds the keys to your entire professional existence.
Wow.
They control your funding, your contract renewals, your access to publications, and your future network.
That is an immense concentration of power for one person to have over another.
It is. And the manifesto makes a profoundly important point here.
Rah.
Good intentions do not fix structural power imbalances.
That is such a critical line. Good intentions do not fix structural power imbalances. You can have a department full of incredibly kind, well-meaning professors.
But the vulnerability is still baked right into the system.
Exactly. But how do you actually enforce a structural firewall in a system where a single professor essentially funds and dictates the student's research?
You do it by decentralizing the power. The document mandates concrete structural firewalls to protect these junior staff members. For example, it proposes mandatory guidance teams.
Okay, so what does that look like?
This means a PhD student doesn't just report to one all-powerful boss. They have multiple points of contact, creating a system of checks and balances.
Oh, I see. So if a relationship with the promoter turns toxic, the student isn't completely isolated. They have somewhere to go.
Precisely. Furthermore, it insists on structured, mandatory exit interviews for anyone leaving the faculty.
To ensure leadership actually learns from departures rather than just sweeping them under the rug.
Right. And it also demands completely transparent procedures for the non-renewal of contracts. A junior researcher should never be left in the dark about why they aren't being kept on.
That transparency is so important.
The criteria must be clear, communicated early, and objectively measurable.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because everything we have discussed so far is about internal management.
Yes.
But this manifesto also outlines how a 600-year-old theology faculty intends to handle massive external disruptions. Let's look at their stance on diversity.
It's a unique situation.
It is. For a place dedicated to the study of religion, it occupies a unique cultural space, and the approach to inclusivity here is quite radical.
It is remarkably broad. The manifesto insists that the faculty must be a genuinely safe and welcoming space for everyone, and everyone is defined as an incredibly wide spectrum.
We're talking believers from various Christian traditions, believers from other world religions, spiritual seekers.
Agnostics and staunch atheists, all in the same space.
And it explicitly states that no single perspective from any point on that spectrum is allowed to be the enforced norm.
That is the crucial operational detail. The goal isn't to water down theological study. It is to facilitate an environment where rigorous existential dialogue can happen with absolute mutual respect.
Right. An atheist historian and a devout theologian need to be able to debate texts without anyone's fundamental identity being marginalized.
Exactly.
Which brings us to another massive external disruption. How does a centuries-old theology faculty deal with the explosion of artificial intelligence?
Now, that is a big one.
The instinct for many humanities departments has been to panic, right? To ban generative AI entirely or just pretend it isn't fundamentally changing how students learn.
Yeah, bury their heads in the sand. But this document confronts it head on, treating it as an inevitable and useful evolution. The author highlights the need for what the text calls twin competencies.
Twin competencies.
It recognizes that AI is permanently altering the landscape of research. You can use large language models to help translate ancient Greek or Hebrew,
mm-hmm.
or to cross-reference massive databases of historical texts in seconds.
Which is incredible.
It is. But that technical capability is useless and potentially dangerous if it isn't paired directly with critical moral thinking.
So what does that actually look like in a theology classroom? Are they just letting ChatGPT write the papers?
No, not at all. It means they are proposing embedding AI coaching directly into the theological training. They want to teach students how to use the technology, but more importantly, how to ethically evaluate the outputs.
It is an acknowledgement that studying ancient sacred texts and engaging with futuristic tech are not mutually exclusive.
In fact, they require each other. We need the ethical frameworks developed over thousands of years of philosophy and theology to help us navigate the moral implications of artificial intelligence.
I love that. But adapting to the modern world isn't just about adding new tech. It also means making incredibly tough choices about what to leave behind.
Yes. The document uses the phrase curriculum rationalization.
Which is a very polite, diplomatic way of saying they have to make hard decisions about merging or even cutting certain academic programs.
The author openly acknowledges the tension here. They have to balance the classical, foundational theological baggage.
Like the ancient languages and the historical texts?
Right. They balance that with the urgent need to address contemporary societal issues like climate ethics, digital morality, and modern secularism.
And you can't just keep adding classes forever. You eventually run out of hours in the week.
Exactly. It requires the courage to trim the branches so the tree itself can survive and keep growing.
And that forward-looking survivalist perspective extends far beyond their campus in Belgium.
It does.
So what does this all mean for the faculty's place in the wider world? How does a localized European academic institution stay relevant globally?
They have a very specific international strategy, particularly focused on the global South. But what sets this apart is the framing. It isn't presented as a race to secure prestigious partnerships with other elite Western universities just to boost their academic rankings.
Which is the usual playbook.
Right. Instead, it is explicitly framed as a mission of solidarity.
Why does the theology faculty specifically feel a duty to focus on the global South?
Because the center of gravity for global Christianity and many other religious movements has shifted dramatically. It's moved away from Europe and towards Africa, Asia, and Latin America.
That makes total sense.
If a European theology faculty only talks to other European faculties, they are studying a shrinking echo chamber. The idea outlined here is that partnering with KU Leuven should act as a springboard.
A springboard for who?
It is designed to give scholars and institutions from the global South more resources, stronger networks, and increased credibility to enact change in their own home regions. It's about decentering the Western perspective.
But they don't shy away from the practical hurdles of making that happen. The document discusses a very real pressing challenge: the rising tuition fees for students coming from outside the European Economic Area.
It is becoming prohibitively expensive for these scholars to come to Belgium.
To counter that, the manifesto commits to pushing hard to grow their scholarship fund and identifying new sustainable funding streams.
Because it's a recognition that global solidarity can't just be an empty feel-good promise in a brochure.
No.
It has to be a financially supported reality, or it means absolutely nothing.
All of these threads, the well-being, the structural firewalls, the AI integration, the global solidarity, they are all building toward a very specific horizon.
Yes, the timeline here is key.
The Deem's actual mandate is relatively short, just 4 years, from 2026 to 2030. But the author's gaze is fixed much further down the road, straight toward that monumental 600th anniversary in 2032.
The document is fundamentally asking deep existential questions about the institution's future. How does a faculty of theology remain relevant, let alone essential, in a society that is rapidly secularizing?
Right.
How do they prepare the next generation of scholars to engage meaningfully with both a traditional church environment and a heavily secular, tech-driven world?
And the way the manifesto concludes is fascinating because it uses a framework to tie all these future-facing goals together that you would really only find in a theology document.
Right. The Apostle Paul.
Yes. It uses the Apostle Paul's words from 1 Corinthians 13, faith, hope, and love.
But importantly, it does not use them as decorative religious ornaments or spiritual platitudes. It translates those ancient concepts into intensely practical modern management tools.
Let's break those down. How does faith function as a management metric?
Well, in this context, faith is defined as having profound structural trust in the future and the capacity of the academic community.
Okay.
It means believing that the researchers, if given the right environment, will produce valuable work, rather than micromanaging them out of fear.
And hope?
Hope is framed as institutional resilience. It is the capacity to push through difficulties and not be paralyzed by an imperfect reality. It means acknowledging the uncomfortable flaws revealed in the IDEBU Erasmus audit, but choosing the optimism to build solutions anyway.
And love. That seems like the hardest one to apply to a corporate or academic structure.
It is, which is why the document redefines it. Love here isn't a feeling. It is concrete structural care. It is the actual written policies.
The right to disconnect on a Saturday is structural love.
Yes. The mandatory guidance teams that protect a young PhD student from a toxic power dynamic are structural love.
The diversity plans that protect an agnostic student in a religious debate.
Exactly. That is structural love. It is the mechanism that protects every individual's talents and vulnerabilities.
When you look at this document in its entirety, taking in the historical weight, the audit data, and the forward-looking strategy, it is so much more than a standard election program for an academic dean.
It's a comprehensive masterclass in how to build a resilient organization.
It proves that you can treat people like complex, vulnerable human beings while still relentlessly driving toward elite, world-class output.
It completely validates the idea that well-being and excellence are symbiotic. You cannot sustain one without the other.
For you listening right now, these concepts are entirely transferable to whatever field you are in. Look at your own teams. Are you relying on the good intentions of management, or are there actual structural firewalls in place to protect the vulnerable voices in your office?
Are you protecting your inner freedom with a real right to disconnect?
Right. Or are you letting the chronic pressure of work bleed into every hour of your life? This document offers a deeply human paradigm for leadership that we could all learn from.
This raises an important question, something for you to mull over after we wrap up today.
Let's hear it.
If a nearly 600-year-old institution, one literally dedicated to the meticulous study of ancient texts and traditions, can recognize that its very survival depends entirely on protecting human vulnerability, acknowledging structural power dynamics, and boldly embracing the ethics of artificial intelligence, what excuses do our modern, supposedly agile and innovative corporations really have for clinging to outdated cultures of burnout?